Okay. All right, so we are going to then, I'm trying to follow how we're going to be going on the trip, although this is not always logical, chronologically, or even geographically, but this is how it works. So, last time we basically covered day one, two, and three of the trip, day three being a very, very busy day. All the days are pretty busy. On day four, we go past Cana to Nazareth. So let's pick up with Nazareth. So Tiberias is where our hotel is. You go north around the lake to get to Capernaum. Then we come back down here. Now here's Nazareth, like a straight shot here. So it's just fine on your map if you can't see. Cana's way over here. You see Cana on your map? There is great controversy, however, about whether that's really Cana or not. There are actually two different places that claim to be Cana. And this one's closer than the one most people say it is. But I don't think we're going into Cana. I think what I recall when I was there before, we passed a highway sign that said Cana this way. And that's about as close as we got. So there's no tour around. There are tourist things here. If you go into Cana, this is where the wedding was. Y'all remember that's what Cana is. This is where the water is turned into wine. So it's Episcopalian's favorite spot in all the Holy Land. All right, so let's get to Nazareth. You will remember in the Gospel of John when Jesus has called Philip to be a disciple, and Philip goes and tells Nathanael, I found the Messiah. He's from Nazareth, and that's when Nathanael says, has anything good ever come out of Nazareth, right? Grab your phone. Nazareth was not a well-known or well-regarded place, obviously. It was not a very big place back in Jesus' time. It's a pretty big town now. And it's not mentioned in things like trade routes, or it's not on the way to anything, right? So it's just this little village here. Remember last time, I think we talked about Sepphoris was a new city being built by Herod Antipas, and they used tradesfolk from Nazareth to build it. So most likely Joseph worked in Sepphoris building it. That's right about the time it was being built, around 20 AD. And Jesus probably did as well as an apprentice carpenter. So it's very close to Nazareth and a much larger place. There are some excavations being done in Nazareth that show perhaps remnants of civilization even back to the time of the Joshua leading the Israelites into the Promised Land. So this is one area where they would have taken up residence. But you could just call it kind of a little hick town, right? In the middle of nothing else much. However, we do say that, you know, it's a biblical prophecy that the Messiah will come from Nazareth, although Jesus obviously is not born in Nazareth, but that's where they go back to, right, to be raised. So we'll see several things in Nazareth, so let's just start about talking about some of the stuff. So what main event happened in Nazareth at the beginning of the story? The Annunciation, right? So this is where Mary lived. Right? We don't know if her family were natives to Nazareth. That's just where she was growing up. So the Annunciation, when Gabriel comes to appear to Mary, it takes place in Nazareth. So what you have in town is the Basilica of the Annunciation. Basilica means church. It's a huge church. And it kind of takes up a whole city block in Nazareth. And in fact, some believe that it's basically about the size of the entire village during Jesus' time, because it wasn't a very big village. And so they built, like we've talked over and over again, they built churches on all these sites. This is a very, very large church. Has a lot of images of Mary from all what they had. You'll see this in two different places, at the Annunciation site, the Basilica of Annunciation, and also when we visit John the Baptist village that he grew up in. There's a church built at where the Visitation supposedly took place when Mary visited Elizabeth, right? So in both of those places, they have artwork depicting those scenes from countries all over the world and in all different languages, like the Magnificat at the Basilica of Annunciation has all these churches that contributed Madonnas, basically, with the words of Magnificat in their home language. At the Visitation, it's the same, the words of the Visitation when Mary meets Elizabeth and is in all these different languages and different artwork that depicts those things. It's pretty cool. Okay, so there was an Italian architect who built the Basilica of Annunciation. It's not ancient by any means, but it is a pretty gorgeous building. It has a very tall tower over it that lights up at night. We won't be there at night, so we won't get to see it. But the big light from the dome has words around it like light came into the darkness, and darkness was not able to overcome it. You know, that kind of stuff. It has here the Word was made flesh. There's a lot of different things inscripted around it. The dome color is the color of the winter tents the Bedouins would have lived in. Y'all know what Bedouins are? It's, you know, just they're still there in Israel. They're wandering people who live in tents, and you will see them. We'll pass them on the highway sometimes with sheep, and they just have they're protected by the government. They won't pay taxes. They don't have to pay taxes, and they move from place to place just like they have for centuries. It was just a very common way to live all the way back to Abraham's time, right? So the reason the dome was the color of the winter of the tents of the Bedouins was there's writing on there that talks about when the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. You know, I think I said this last time, maybe in this class or the night class. The literal translation of that in the Greek is the Word became flesh and pitched a tent among the people, literally. So that going back to that way of living, you know, in tents. And so that's why they thought about a lot of this stuff, right, when they build these things. So anyway,
what color?
It's not pretty. It's kind of dusty. The tents blend in to the landscape. So, yeah. I'm not saying Jesus lived in a tent. That's just literally what the word means. Okay. There are words engraved all around this place about prophecy, like from Isaiah. They will call his name Emmanuel. He shall be, you know, Prince of Peace, Lord of Lords, all that kind of stuff. Those kind of things. So it's all this stuff, of course, tribute to this is where Mary was given the news that she would give birth to the Son of God, and then, of course, where Jesus was raised. All right? So there's the church itself, when you go inside, is gorgeous. Beautiful mosaic floors and things like that. A really amazing altar that some people have been known sometimes when the guards aren't looking to go under the ropes and stand at. I've never actually seen that myself. That's my official word on that, but it's really a cool place, and it is an active church. They have church services there. You can't be part of that unless you've reserved time and space for that. So typically, the tours aren't going on while that's going on in there. Okay, so there's a grotto on the ground level, you know, kind of a cave-like place. And above it is where they claim the Annunciation took place, kind of a cave house. There was a room built on the front of it that is no longer there. People took pieces of it bit by bit so it doesn't exist anymore. So then in the Byzantine times are like 400 to 1300 AD, I think. Any history buffs in here? But early Byzantine times, of course, they built a church next to the grotto. And then when the Crusaders came in, and the Crusaders built a lot of churches too, they built stuff on top of these things. This is an old place where they did that. You can see the wall from the Crusader building is still there. In the back of it is a baptismal pool where early Christians were baptized. The altar that you'll see there is from an addition made to it in the 1600s by the Franciscans, who acquired the property and were managing it. They did a lot of that in the Holy Land. We talked about that some last time. It just kind of gets all piled on top of each other. It just gets a little disconcerting at times, but some beautiful stuff. Then the upper church is where the worship services take place. That's a Catholic Arab community. So they're Arabic people who are Christian Catholics. Nazareth is mainly Arabs, and you'll see Arabic street signs and things like that, as well as English and some Hebrew in there. But it's more Christian than it is Jewish in Nazareth itself. And they will say Mass in Arabic. So if you know Arabic, you can do that. I don't. Okay. They even have a mosaic that has the Constitution of the Catholic Church from Vatican II written on it. So it's very Catholic. Let's see. Madonnas come from France, Japan, Mexico, Poland, Canada, United States, Cuba, Germany, et cetera, et cetera. All right. So trying to think why this Isaiah quote is in here. Okay, so we will spend a good bit of time. It takes a while to see everything there in the church. There's also near to the church another church called St. Joseph's Church, named, of course, after Mary's husband, Joseph. And you will see down there, it's a very small little altar area, and they also have some artifacts from the time that carpenters would have used back 2,000 years ago. That, you know, it's not saying Joseph actually held this saw, but this is what the kind of rudimentary tools that they would have used during that time that they have set up in a kind of museum-like stuff. So it is that location of that church has a very ancient tradition of being a place pilgrims would visit. And so the idea was that this was possibly where their home was, also where Joseph's shop would have been part of the home. And so there's been some excavations of some of this stuff there that you'll see when you go in there. Has an altar to the Holy Family there, which is, I did get to, without getting in trouble, stand at that altar. And for Forbes' ordination, when I went the first time, I took a handful of stoles that were made in Honduras. This gorgeous stoles, you might have seen me wearing some on before, that Jennifer got for me when she would go to Honduras, or I got them when I was there. And I took them and blessed them on that altar of the Holy Family, because that's the only one I could really get access to without being yelled at. And so I gave Forbes one of those. That was my ordination gift to him, was when I was blessed on that altar. So it's weird to have a Honduran stole blessed in the Holy Land, but I thought it was pretty. So it'll all work. It all ties together, right? So possibly that's the first, if you want to call it, Christian community, or the first Christian family. That might be a stretch, but you know, Jesus, with Jesus part of your family, that makes you a Christian family, I guess, right? Since that's his name. We don't know if Jesus, you know, the H in Jesus' name, his middle name is named after Joseph or not. I haven't been figured out yet. So Jesus H. Christ, we're not real sure. All right, so there's a synagogue also in that area that we may have a chance to take a look at. This is probably not, you know, there is a story in Luke where, chapter 4 of Luke, why don't we look at it? Let's look at it first. Chapter 4, verse 14. I'll just... Read chapter 4, 14 through 24, someone.
Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee, and news about him spread throughout the whole countryside. He taught in their synagogue and was praised by everyone. Jesus went to Nazareth, where he had been raised. On the Sabbath, he went to the synagogue as he normally did and stood up to read. Synagogue assistant gave him the scroll from the prophet Isaiah. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, as the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to preach good news to the poor, to proclaim release to the prisoners, and recovery of sight to the blind, to liberate the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. He rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the synagogue assistants, and sat down. Every eye in the synagogue was fixed on him. He explained to them, "Today, this scripture has been fulfilled just as you heard it." Everyone was raving about Jesus. So impressed were they by the gracious words flowing from his lips. They said, "This is Joseph's son, isn't it?" Then Jesus said to them, "Undoubtedly, you will quote this saying to me, 'Doctor, heal yourself. Do here in your hometown what you heard you did in Capernaum, what we've heard you did in Capernaum.'" He said, "I assure you that no prophet is welcome in the prophet's hometown."
Right. So stay there because we're going to finish that story in a second. So here's the deal. Jesus comes back to Nazareth, right? This is after baptism and temptation in Luke. So he's out in the wilderness for 40 days. In the Luke version of the story, then he comes to Nazareth. Verse 14, that first verse Van read, filled with the power of the Spirit. That's the big Luke thing. All about the Holy Spirit. Returns to Galilee. Reported about it spread throughout the surrounding county. So he's making his way to Nazareth, and he goes into the synagogue on the Sabbath day, as was his custom, right? He's a good, faithful Jew, right? Worshipping on the Sabbath as he should. And he stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. So an interesting thing we have learned from the Dead Sea Scrolls is this passage from Isaiah was one of their primary passages that they read in Qumran. It's Isaiah 61, about proclaiming the good news to the poor and release to the captives and that kind of stuff. So that gives credence to Jesus that this would have been one they'd used in their synagogue worship a lot as well. So he reads from the scroll, and then he sits down to preach. And I've told you many times before, we've got it backwards. Y'all should be standing, and I should be sitting when preaching. Maybe I'll do that for the 100-word sermon this Sunday. Right, so it says in verse 20, everybody's looking at him, right? And then he says, "Today the scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." And what did they do? They spoke well of him. They're amazed. This is our boy, right? This is Joseph's son. Yay, Jesus, they're saying in Hebrew. And however you say it, Yahshua. Yay, Yahshua. Is that Hebrew? Yay? I don't know. Anybody know yay in Hebrew? So Jesus, you know, he's like, "Yeah, you're not gonna be cheering for long. I hadn't finished my message yet," because he moves from preaching to meddling, right? And so he says to them, "Doubtless you'll quote to me, 'Doctor, cure yourself.' Can't you do here in your hometown what you did in Capernaum?" And that's when he says, "A prophet is not accepted in a prophet's hometown." So it's hard for him to do miraculous work there. But then he starts really getting under their skin, right? So he's the favored son for a minute. I've had this exact feeling in the middle of the sermon, right? And then he shifts to say, "But the truth is," in verse 25, "there are many widows in Israel in the time of Elijah." Elijah was not sent to any of the Israel widows. In fact, this is the Old Testament reading for this coming Sunday. Instead, he goes to a widow at Zarephath in Sidon, which is way up here, right? That's where Elijah goes. And that's the widow who's dying with her son, and Elijah does the miracle of replenishing the yeast so they can have bread to eat every day while there's a famine going on, right? So in other words, God sent his prophet Elijah, the number one prophet, to a non-Jew and sustains her during this time. So that's the story he tells. There are plenty of widows God could have sent Elijah to in Israel, but no, God takes care of everybody. Then there's a story of the leper, verse 27, Elisha. There's plenty of lepers in Israel that Elisha could have cured, but no, he cures Naaman the Syrian, right, a non-Jew. And so in verse 28, when they heard this, they were all filled with rage. So Jesus takes that passage from Isaiah to talk about hope to the poor and release of the captives and extrapolates it to mean, as your scripture says, is not just for you. And that irritates them so bad they want to kill him, right? So they rise up against him and they take him out of town. You see in verse 29, they drove him out of town, led him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built, so they might hurl him off the cliff. But then he just walked through them, and they parted and let him come by. So very dramatic change in what happens. So all that takes place in Nazareth. In Luke, we don't hear Jesus going back to Nazareth again after that. So he's kind of done with his hometown at that point. Okay? So that's other than the Old Testament scripture that says the Messiah will be a Nazarene, which although born in Bethlehem is also from the Old Testament, it says he's going to be a Nazarene growing up in Nazareth, so that's where they come back and settle to. And so, of course, Nazareth is a very important spot. I'll have to ask Russell. Russell did a trip to the, Russell, our bishop. He did a walking tour, hiking tour of the Holy Land. I think he walked.
He took the Jesus Trail.
Yeah.
From Nazareth to the Sea of Galilee.
That's what it was. Yeah, yeah. All the way here to the Sea of Galilee. Thank you. Yeah, that would be pretty cool. 60 kilometers? Wow. So this is 20 kilometers. Yep. So one thing to know about, that's not really a biblical thing, but an interesting thing, has nothing to do with Nazareth. But in this area here above Tiberias, heading to the sea, there is kind of hilly, and there's like these two high points. And when you go in between them, you can see the lake. You can see the Sea of Galilee. So on July 4th of 1180-something, the Crusaders were coming across this way, and it was a really, really, really hot day. And when they went between those two hills and they could see the Sea of Galilee, they were so hot and thirsty, and they take off all their armor, lay down their weapons, and run for the lake to jump in it, and the Turkish armies were waiting for them and slaughtered them on their way to the lake. So I don't know if they're... Maybe it's, oh, it's the Sea of Galilee. This is Jesus' lake, because they had a lot of that going on. Or it's just, it's so daggum hot, we want to get in the water. But it was a bad strategic move for them. So there's a lot of Crusader stuff, and you'll hear a lot of it when you go there, particularly where they built things and then they were torn down, or where the battles were fought over several hundred years for that. Okay? So also on your map, do you see Mount Tabor? To the east of Nazareth. All right, so your map has Cana right here. Right? Is it Mr.? Yeah, well, that's right. Mr. Tabor lives there. And this map has Cana way over here. This is the alternate site that I was telling you about, well, this argument over Cana. So if what they're describing to us from Tiberias and Nazareth, we would go right by the Cana that's on your map. So that might have been confusing to you a while ago. Sorry about that. But it depends on the map maker, which Cana they want to believe in. All right. So Mount Tabor is site of two biblical things. I don't think we're going there, but just so you know, since it's on your map, that's the Transfiguration Mountain, and it's also where Jesus appears to the disciples at the end of the Gospel of Matthew. When he says, go to Galilee, and I will meet you there. And so when the story picks up, he's in Galilee up on the mountain. That's when he tells them, go and make disciples and baptize. His last instructions to them. We think, a lot of these things they call mountains are just hills, just higher places in there, so that's there. All right. We also will go to Mary's Well, which is right outside of Nazareth, as I recall. It is a small spot. It wasn't on the original plan, but I liked it, so I asked them to include it because it's close to all the stuff we're going to. So we'll spend a few minutes there, I think. It's still a well. The legend about Mary's Well is, it's also a church and a school, but it's not a real big place, is that there was a legend, it's not a biblical thing, but there's a legend that Mary had a premonition about the Annunciation before Gabriel actually did appear to her, where she had a dream or something about something big was going to happen having to do with an angel, and that she was at that well drawing water when that happened to her. So that's why it's been kind of a holy site ever since that time. But you'll see that. It's just a little well, I guess. Okay, and then we will go to Mutraka, and then to Armageddon. So I don't know where those are, if they are on your map. Do you see Megiddo below Nazareth? It's on the blue map. All right. Megiddo is Armageddon, and Mutraka is the site where Elijah. You remember the story of Elijah and his contest with the prophets of Baal, right? Is on Mount Hermon. So Mount Hermon is really a series of hills. It's not really one big mountain, so it's on Mount Hermon, and Mutraka is actually the site of it. And so he's challenging and making fun of all the prophets of Baal, and they build altars and say, whoever can call upon their God to light this altar on fire, sacrifice whatever it is the real God. And then he pours water all over his wood and all that kind of stuff to make it harder. And they try for, you know, all day long, calling upon their gods, Baal and other gods, to light the fire. Nothing ever happens. And then, you know, Elijah lights that one and it goes up immediately. I mean, God does for Elijah's behalf. And then, you know, the lovely part of that story is that they didn't kill all the other prophets out there on the site. So, anyway, that altar, they could sacrifice people, I guess. Anyway, so we'll stop there for that. The false prophets are defeated there. And then we go to the Valley of Armageddon, to this excavation site called Tel Megiddo. Have any of you ever read any James Michener books? Have you read The Source? Yeah, so that's the archaeological dig that it starts off with, is Tel Megiddo. If you haven't read that, it's only about 1,200 pages. You can probably get done between now and the trip. So another way of saying this in Arabic is Hal Megiddo, which is eventually becomes Armageddon. So that's the place to stop. When you read Armageddon in Revelation, it's a mispronunciation of Megiddo. Right, so Har means valley. So it's the Valley of Megiddo becomes Armageddon just because they pronounce it wrong eventually. So that's where Armageddon. It's the same place. All right, this is a really cool place. So the archaeological work that's been done there is fascinating. It goes way back before Jesus' time, before perhaps Moses' time. This area, Megiddo is really farmland. It's in this valley, and it's very, it grows crops, etc. But there also is a site of some battles way back when. It also was a site of a battle in 1918. So this is the 100th year anniversary of that, in World War I, where the Turks were defeated, right there on that same place. Right? And so, in the symbolic language that Revelation has about there will be a battle to end all battles, right? It will take place at this place where there have been a lot of battles, right? And it's, you can see that armies can come from a lot of different places to do battle on this big field. So that's why it's kind of set up that way in Revelation. But there's these archaeological digs where they unearth this stuff. It just goes back centuries and centuries and centuries and centuries ago. And you can even go inside it and go down a little staircase down into the dig and that kind of stuff. It's just really fascinating. Let's see if there's anything else I want to tell you about Megiddo. Probably we'll spend a good bit of time there, will be my guess, but I'm not in charge. So let's see. Why don't y'all turn to Revelation? See, when you put post-its on things and write places for you to turn your page to, and then the post-its fall off, makes it really difficult. All right. I'll tell you what, if I can't find it, I'll just make it up. First one to find Armageddon in Revelation wins the prize. Ah, there we go. And they assembled them at the place in Hebrew is called Harmageddon. Right? So, you read just above that. The angels are pouring out the stuff out of their bowls with the wrath of God, etc. If you want to know what that means, you need to read Left Behind. Yes, that was supposed to be humorous. Thank you for laughing. Okay, and then they assemble a place called Armageddon, and then later it talks about the great battle that's to take place there. The final battle.
And then calling it Armageddon here is just a mistranslation from the Galilee.
Yep, of Megiddo. Right.
Megiddo.
Right. Or an English messed up translation. You'll look at it. Okay. So, some of the things we do are really more about just ancient history as much as it is about Jesus and stuff like that. But again, it's, Megiddo kind of separates, it's even on this map. Down here, it kind of separates Samaria from Galilee. It's in the Jezreel Valley. So because of its location between Egypt and the northern empires like Babylonia and Assyria, you know, over time, those different ones, it was a place where armies would have met along the way when they're fighting over who was in charge of the stuff. And the northern kingdom of Israel is right in the middle of it all the time. In fact, there's so much fighting going on, you don't have to turn there, but in the book of Hosea, the prophet Hosea, God tells Hosea to name his son after the Jezreel Valley. Give him the name Jezreel, for in a little while I will punish the royal dynasty of the northern kingdom for the carnage at Jezreel. So he has to name his son after this terrible place. It's like you named your kid Pearl Harbor or something, you know. So it's not valley. Har is not valley. It's hill. I have that wrong, right? So the reputation for battles in that valley was so tenacious that when the author of Revelation took Hill of Megiddo in Hebrew is Harmageddon. Harmageddon, said really fast, becomes Armageddon, right? And that's where the great last conflict will take place. General Allenby of Great Britain defeated the Ottoman Empire there in 1918, and he was given the title Lord Allenby of Megiddo. After that point. So archaeological excavations from at least Solomon's time, but there's some stuff that they have found that show a lot of pagan-type worship similar to what Canaanites would have done. So it goes way, way, way back in time there. So it's a place that's been a place of worship, if you want to call it that, for a really, really, about almost as long as we know about civilization in that area. So it's an important spot for that. Okay? Armageddon. All right, from there we're going to travel to Caesarea on the Mediterranean Sea. So you got Caesarea Philippi up here and then Caesarea over here on the coast.
It's one day.
Yep. You have to listen carefully to the guides because we'll be covering a lot of stuff. Everybody see Caesarea on your map? It's not on the blue map, it's on this one. Right? Bless you. So it's southwest of Nazareth on the Mediterranean Sea. So turn in your Bibles to Acts, I think it's chapter 10. All you Acts people should know. Yeah, so chapter 10 of Acts. That's the biblical story that includes Caesarea in it. So this is where Cornelius lives, a centurion who was a devout man and feared God, etc. He gets a vision that he needs to meet up with Peter. Meanwhile, Peter has a vision that he's supposed to meet with Cornelius. And that's when the vision of all the unclean food comes down on the sheet from heaven, and God tells Peter to get up and eat. And Peter's like, no, I've never eaten anything that wasn't kosher. And God says, no, I'm telling you, everything's okay. It's not about what goes into your mouth. It's about what comes out that is unclean. And it's a way for Peter to understand that this whole deal about Jesus is for the Gentiles as well as it is for the Jews. Right? So Peter has this conversion experience about that. And then Cornelius shows up at his door, and Cornelius gets baptized. So Peter baptizes him. All that takes place in Caesarea. So that's where I'm going. It's also a neat city. There's a lot of, I don't know how much time we'll have for that, but there's a lot of excavations going on in that area as well. This Caesarea has, it's always had a Roman amphitheater, and they've kind of fixed it up where they actually have concerts there now. They've added lighting and sound systems to it, but it's the amphitheater with the same stones and all that kind of stuff. You can see Roman aqueducts are still preserved in that area, how they brought water across. A lot of good Roman stuff there, if you're interested in that kind of thing, at Caesarea. There's also some work done by the Crusaders in that area as well, and hopefully we'll get to see some of that too. So Caesarea was built in 22 BC by Herod the Great. It had a big port. It's a big place. Also, at the end of Acts in chapter 25, if you remember when Paul was going to trial, he was brought to Caesarea, and that's where he was kept in jail for a couple of years. So all that takes place in this town. I don't think so. And it really wasn't a jail as much as it was a house arrest kind of thing. Remember, people could visit him, and the governor kept going to him for wanting money from him, and he kept getting turned down. Okay, so that's the end of day 4. Not much going on there, right? So Nazareth, Mary's Well, Mount Hermon, Armageddon, and Caesarea. So we're traveling from Tiberias down here, Armageddon's down this way, and over here to Caesarea. And then we go back to Tiberias to spend the night one more time on the Sea of Galilee. Okay. You want to keep going? It's 11:15. Yeah, we got at least 15 more minutes, right? Okay. Let's get on the road again. On the road again. Baptismal site, Yardanet, is not on your map. So here's the deal about that. We know Jesus was baptized where? In the Jordan River. Now, in South Mississippi and Hancock County, there's a Jordan River. It's spelled the same, Jordan, but there's a lot of Cajuns down there. So it's the River Jordan, and it's not the same one. So until somebody threw it away at St. Paul's Delray Beach, I had a bottle of water from the Jordan River in Israel that I always would put in the font for baptisms, whenever I did baptisms. But when I was at St. Patrick's in Long Beach, I didn't have that, and I've been to Holy Land, so I got some water out of the Jordan River. And I would tell them, so we have water from the Jordan River, to say real fast like that, and they were like, oh, isn't that great? So, yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yes. And I will try and do that again. And they're okay with you taking that on the plane and stuff like that. Just don't drink it. So we don't know, despite what you may be told, the exact location of where Jesus was baptized. All we know is it was in the Jordan River. Right? So the Jordan River comes all the way down. This is a lake that's almost completely drained of water now, but it comes down here, goes into the Sea of Galilee, which is a lake, and then again continues all the way into the Dead Sea, right? So it's running through here, going to the Dead Sea, where it dies like everything else. All right? So somewhere in here, on the Jordan River, is where the baptism takes place. Now, the really smart people have kind of narrowed that down based on what they understand from the scriptures and where John the Baptist would have been, et cetera. But that particular spot is not currently open to the public, although they're working on it, because it was a minefield during the Israeli-Jordan conflict. And that's, we found that to be not okay for tourists to walk across minefields. Sometimes that can be a problem. So this Yardanet became the spot that tourists could go to if you want to be on the Jordan River, be baptized or rebaptized. Rebaptized is not a real thing, but to reenact your baptism on the Jordan River. So Yardanet is a spot built for that. And so when you go there, it's a pretty big complex. There's a gift shop, of course. There's a restaurant. And they have a lot, like 8 or 9 or 10 different places. The river's really wide. There's kind of pools coming off of it in this area. And so they have steps. Somebody's home. They have steps that help you down into the water. And so when you go, you're going to see a lot of people in white robes being baptized or reenacted about it, what do you want to call it, in the Jordan River. There'll be all kind of groups doing that. So we're going to do that if any of you that are going are interested in it. You have to wear a white robe that they provide. So over a bathing suit. So if you're interested in that, make sure you brought a bathing suit. You're going to need it for the Dead Sea anyway, if you're going to float, which you should. And then for $10, you rent their robe. They also give you a certificate and access to showers afterwards. So everybody looks the same going into the water. I didn't know that when I was there. I was like, how do all these people know to all bring white robes, you know, for this stuff? Now, they playing way better than we did, right? So, yes, Mary? Oh, thank you. Yardanet. I'm probably mispronouncing it. Well, that's because I'm probably butchering it. It's probably Hazenhut or something like that. But anyway, that's what we'll call it until our guide tells us that's way wrong, which he will. So it's a non-profit place. They're not really trying to milk you, although there are things you can buy water there. You can, the olive oil that I, no, it didn't come from there. It came from the Mount of Olives. Never mind. I also have olive oil from Holy Land out of youth for baptisms, because the bishop's blessed it. Anyway, they have capability if you do to go through these baptism things. They have kind of a little amphitheater where you could have a worship service if you wanted to. I'm going to work with the guide and see. I think this would be a cool place to have Eucharist if we have time. They have planned for us Eucharist on our last day at the Garden Tomb, which we'll talk about next time, which is a fascinating place. But no reason why we can't have Eucharist more than once. We have a priest, right? So anyway, I think the Jordan River is a cool place to do it. So anyway, if you want to go in and get dunked, which would be the perfect thing to do in the Jordan River, although good Catholics and Episcopalians and Methodists know people that sprinkle babies will tell you, well, you know, probably when Jesus was baptized, the Jordan River doesn't always have a lot of water in it. And he probably was just standing about ankle deep, and they probably just sprinkled some water on his head. That makes us feel better about our little bird bath baptismal font. Now, St. Andrew's, Panama City, has the most gorgeous baptismal font, and I tried to take it when I was down there delivering stuff to you guys, but I was told it would be missed. So one day, I sent Van a picture, I think just Van, of this baptism a friend of mine was doing, where it was like a Greek Orthodox baptism. So it was a naked baby, and their font is like goes all the way around out here. It's about this deep, and you can just swoop those babies in there appropriately, baptize people. One day. Maybe we'll build one out here. That will be so amazing. Yeah. Isn't that phenomenal?
So are you baptizing us?
Yeah. Yep. Now, I will give you one warning. Hopefully this will not happen unto you. And some of y'all have heard this story probably 10 or 12 times, but while we were there, Jennifer and I were walking into the river to fill up a water bottle on some steps, and there's this sweet young little innocent girl who was part of our tour, like 17 or 18 years old, walking with us and her parents. And as we're stepping into the water, a nutria swims up to the steps. Do you know what a nutria is? Maybe the most disgusting creature God ever made. And they are not native at all to the Middle East. They were brought to Louisiana from like New Zealand or something to eat some kind of vegetation. So whenever we mess with the ecology, we screw it up, right? So they have exploded in population in South Louisiana and South Mississippi and all the swamps kind of down there. And they're basically giant rats, like this big with web feet. Yeah, and long tails. They're gross. Oh, they're so gross. And they're horrid things. And because there's so many of them now in South Louisiana and South Mississippi, the alligator population has exploded because alligators, turns out, love nutria. So now we have way more gators than we ever had before. And the nutria, y'all know geography of Mississippi, but the Pearl River runs down the kind of middle of Mississippi and it branches out. Part of it goes to Louisiana, part of it goes to Mississippi into the swampland. But the Pearl River is in Jackson, Mississippi, and so now there's a bunch of nutria that have made their way up to the Pearl River, and there's a huge reservoir up there, so there's nutria all over the reservoir in Jackson now, which means also there's a lot more gators in the reservoir in Jackson. We were coming out of a restaurant one time right there on the reservoir, catfish place, and this little family of nutria come walling out from underneath the restaurant, so I never ate there again. So anyway, this demon from hell comes swimming up while we're trying to walk in and just kind of ruin the mood, right? I was like, why are you here? I was just yelling at it. Why are you here? You should be in Louisiana being eaten by an alligator. How did you get here? I don't even understand it. I can't even tell. How did you make this trip? Who brought you? You know, so hopefully it's the only one, or maybe it was a dream. But that young lady I was with goes, oh, isn't that the sweetest, cutest little thing? It looks like a little teddy bear. I said, what is wrong with you? Look at that horrid creature. So anyway, hopefully, and they won't bother you. They're scared of you. And if you want to go to South Louisiana, South Mississippi, you get $5 a pelt for nutria. They want you to kill them. All you have to do is bring a leg or something to prove that you killed one. And there's a company that makes dog food out of the meat of the nutria, just trying to do something with them. And after Hurricane Gustav, which was 2 years after Katrina, which hit South Louisiana, South Mississippi, it was not a big hurricane, but it did hit where all the nutria live, and there were 15,000 dead nutria washed up on Highway 90 down there, and we had to get front-end loaders. And so you talk about it was, that's part of why I cannot stand those things. But it's a holy place, Yardinette. Did I mention that? It's really lovely.
One of God's creatures.
Yeah, it is, but I'm not sure about that, actually. Anyway, it's our own fault that they're there. I don't know why they're in Israel. It's got to be a plot by somebody to do something terrible. Yeah, really. All right, so we'll probably spend a good bit of time at the baptismal site just because it's a cool place to be. From there, we're going to a Roman city, Beit She'an. I'm not familiar with it at all, and I don't have any information for you on that. And I don't know if it's on any of these maps or not. But I went to not this city, but another one like it when I was there. It's just one of those places that they've done great excavation and archaeological work where you can really see what it was like in Roman times, the Roman Empire, you know, the baths and the amphitheaters and all that kind of stuff, well preserved in there, so you spend a little time doing that. All right, so then we're going to go to this little town of Bethlehem, that's it. Yeah, it's a song. Very good. All right, so so Yardinette is somewhere down in this area, and I'm not sure where that Roman city is. Okay, I can't all see this map, can you? So you will see on your map Jericho. You have to be this map, right? And then Jerusalem and Bethlehem. Okay, so this is a nice little ride, first of all, from there. We will pass Jericho on the way, and again, it's another one of these street signs, Jericho this way. We're not going to Jericho, unfortunately, but there's some really cool excavation stuff going on there. But they can't keep digging these walls up because people keep marching around them and blowing horns and they fall down. It's just really trouble. Yeah, don't bring your horn. No shofars for you. So there's several things. Of course, Bethlehem, we all know all about that. And some of you have been before, right? Anybody? No? All right. Well, the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, let me find my spot on that, is if you've ever watched Christmas Eve from Bethlehem, you'll see pictures out in this big courtyard, right, and then some pictures inside the church, probably. So everybody masses outside in that courtyard. They can't all fit inside the church. So you'll be on that courtyard. It's not as big as it looks on TV. And then the Church of the Nativity is really amazing. There's actually several churches that are part of it, or several denominations that rule over it. I know you all memorized my sermon from my first Christmas Eve here, talking about how rushed we got in there. It will be a madhouse. The closer we get to Jerusalem, the more people there will be, and so you just have to deal with it. So I thought I had a picture. Who wrote that song? Don't look it up in the hymnal. You can't answer. Nope. He has a statue outside of Trinity Copley Square in Boston. He's Episcopal Bishop.
Oh.
Phillips Brooks. If you've never read any of his sermons, you should. He's maybe the best Episcopal preacher that ever walked the earth, Phillips Brooks. He was a bishop, but he served Trinity Copley Square before he was elected bishop. So there's a big statue of him. And the first time I preached in seminary was on the feast day of Phillips Brooks. And the preaching professor chooses who gets to preach when. And so he sent me a note saying, "You remind me of Phillips Brooks." And I was like, "I don't know who that is, but that's a pretty..." So I started reading, this great preacher, all that kind of stuff. I said, "What's that nice?" Well, it turns out Phillips Brooks was about 6'7" and weighed about 360 pounds. So that's what reminded him between me and him. So I didn't like that. Yeah, it was true. True story. This is a true story. He said, "Turn to page 43. And you'll see why I say that." And so I turned to page 34, I flipped the numbers accidentally, and it says Phillips Brooks was known as one of the greatest preachers ever in the Episcopal Church. I said, "Man, my preaching professor said about me?" And I looked at the note again, I had it wrong, it's 43, not 34, so I turned to 43, and it says, "Phillips Brooks entered Virginia Seminary as ill-prepared to be a seminarian as any student ever." Right. So I'm fat and dumb, basically, what you're telling me. It's true. It's all true. So, obviously, that came out in the sermon. Right?
Oh, my. Well, he came out of it well.
Yeah. Yes, true. Bethlehem is an interesting place. I can describe this from my experience going there. We'll see if it's the same for us. But our guide was not allowed to go to Bethlehem. So there's a checkpoint, a Palestinian checkpoint that you go through to go to Bethlehem. Was originally part of Jordan. And I think over the years it's come back under Israeli thing, but it's still, you have to go through these checkpoints. I don't really understand all of it. But they would not let our guide, Jewish guide, come into Bethlehem. He said, I'm not allowed in. So the bus goes through the checkpoint. And they check, make sure you're not carrying bombs and stuff. It's really just no big deal. And then a Christian guy picks you up that they've arranged for and takes you on the tour of Bethlehem. So our guide, who was just so amazing, said to us, if you'll help me, I want to go too. So he put on a baseball cap, and he said, I forget what his name was now, but it was very Jewish. He said, I'll just call me Tom or something like that, and don't tell anybody that I'm a guide. And because he said, I've always wanted to see a church in the Nativity. And again, I've told y'all, these guys know the New Testament better than any of us ever thought about knowing it, even though they're not Christian, and most of them aren't even practicing Jews, but they know their stuff. He said, I just want to see it. I hear about it all the time, so can we do this? So he just went with us like he's part of the tour, and he made it, and really had a very moving experience. So the bad thing about the Christian guy that picked us up, and this may happen to us too because it's the same company, well, it's not bad, but this is interesting. Manger Square is the name of the courtyard outside of the church. And after you go through the Church of Nativity, you kind of come back through this little back alleyway, and you end up at a gift shop.
Yeah.
Right? Because there is a gift shop at the end of every ride. We have to remember that. Well, guess who owns the gift shop? The brother of the guide, the Christian guy that took us through there. But it's a nice gift shop. There's a lot of stuff, and you can bargain with them on things. A lot of stuff made out of olive wood and a lot of pretty stuff. Anyway, so Manger Square is that courtyard. And then to enter into the Church of the Nativity, you have to go through this, you have to bend down and go through a door, right? And so it is said that that's there so everybody humbles themselves. Nobody is greater than anybody else to enter into this place where Jesus was born. Well, that sounds really nice. But the truth is, the door was made that small to keep people mounted on horses from coming in and chopping people's heads off. So it was a defense mechanism, but it sounds better the other way, right? Yeah. So it's really kind of fortress-looking, the church is. It's a 6th-century basilica built over a 4th-century church that Queen Helena, who's Constantine's mother, had ordered to be built there. She comes into play also in a Church of the Holy Sepulchre when we get into Jerusalem. Underneath it, the place that's supposedly the birthplace of Jesus, there are caves. So the story, right, of the stable, because there's no room in the inn, a stable in Bethlehem would have been a cave. It would not have been some wooden structure with horse stalls like we think of. That's where they kept the animals, were in caves. That leads credence to this possibly being really the spot, right? And so from early 4th century, the first church was built over that spot. And then later, several hundred years later, this one was built over that one. Now, they're constantly having to work on restoring. There's a lot of tapestries. In their paintings in there, some gorgeous stuff. The floor, they reworked some. It's really amazing artwork and things that are in there. And there's a big altar area that is run. There's 3 churches that control Church of Nativity. So this is the Orthodox Church has the altar area. Have you ever been in an Orthodox church? You'll see a lot of them over there in the Holy Land, and one aspect of them are all these candles, very elaborate candles hanging down all over the place. You'll see that in Church Holy Sepulchre. You see it in Church Nativity too, around their altar stuff. They use a lot of smoke and fire, and it's some gorgeous stuff though. And so, you come in. It's kind of a fortress-looking place, like I said. They made these lower doors so easier to descend. And then you can come into the place through that little door. Once you come in, the guy, you'll see, you know, there's a billion people there. We'll take you around to look at all the different things there. Then if the altar is over here, you come around to this side and you go underneath downstairs behind the altar to the spot. Right? And so this is one of the places where it was interesting to hear all the different languages being spoken. Because you had tours from every place on earth you could think of. So you had this Italian people here, and these German people here, and these Japanese people here. I mean, just all these people from all over the world. And their guys are speaking to them, you know, in their languages. And it's just really amazing. So you go down this staircase, and this is when the story I told in my sermon happened, was that whenever there's a service about to take place on that altar, an Orthodox service, and there's several a day, no one is allowed underneath. So they're about to start this service as we're going about to go down the stairs. And so, actually, we were on the stairs, and a little Orthodox keeper of the guard comes up and says, no, you've got to go back up. Well, we couldn't go back up. There's too many people. So he said, well, you just got to go through and get back in line. Well, that would take him 3 more hours. So our guy's arguing with him back and forth. So he finally says, if you hurry, you can do it. So we basically run through the cave where Jesus was born and back up the stairs again before they started their service. And they have their own little secret entrance to the altar stairs that they go up, and they're going up with their little verger kind of person leading the way as we're going through. They had to wait for us to finish. They were not happy with us when we came through the thing. So hopefully that won't happen to us, because what you'll see when you go down there in the caves, little grotto areas, there's one little place over here that has a silver star in the floor and has some candles and things around it, and that's the birthplace. And over here across in another little indented part of the cave is where they say, well, the manger was over here. So Mary gives birth here, and the manger where Jesus was placed was over here. And so if you have some time to just stop and pray at those spots, that would be really nice. We didn't. You know, we just had to take a look, run upstairs kind of stuff. So hopefully we'll time it a little better, and you can see that kind of stuff. But it's pretty cool. And you can, the stars, whatever, it's kind of weird. But knowing what we now know about stables and things like that in Bethlehem time, it makes sense that something like this, if it wasn't an exact place, is where Jesus was born. Yeah, so it's really cool. So you get a few minutes down there, and you go back upstairs. And when you go back upstairs, there's a Roman Catholic church attached to it. And it just looks like kind of a 20th century Roman Catholic church with pews and all that kind of stuff. So if you ever are watching the Christmas Eve from Bethlehem, you'll see Manger Square, and usually what they show is the Catholic service. But I don't think maybe the Orthodox don't let them show that. Plus, the Catholic service is typically in either Latin or English, where more Catholics could understand what's going on. So you've got that church, and then there are more caves and grottos to see as well. So up above, you kind of go up some back stairs. There's some more little cubicle grotto kind of areas. And in one of those places is where St. Jerome translated the Bible into the Vulgate, which is the Latin version of the Bible, which was the official Bible of the church for centuries. So, and it took him a really like decades and decades to do that. So he had the Greek and the Hebrew, and he translated those into Latin. And he's in this little office, which is part of a cave. And to me, that was just because I love the Bible so much. That was a really cool to think that the Bible that so many Christians used for so long was written right here in this spot. And we know that is where Jerome was. This is not because he was above the Church of the Nativity, which was already built by that time, doing this kind of stuff. So you get to see that as well. He was made to come to Rome at one point in time, but then he came back because he wanted to write it there. It was translated there. It was the inspiration of being on that spot for him. There. So, why don't we finish what we're going to do in Bethlehem real quick, and then we'll be done. So, next thing is what they call the, after the gift shop, I'm sure, is the shepherd's field, which, as you can imagine, is a field of shepherds, with the idea being this is where the angels appeared to the shepherds to announce the birth of Jesus, right? And so, there's a little chapel there as well. And there is a, I didn't get to go to this when I went before, so I'm looking forward to it, but my understanding is there's a bell that you can ring. So as a group, we wanted to sing, we'll get the shepherds to lead us, Glory in Excelsis or whatever, Angels We Have Heard on High or that kind of stuff. They'll let you ring that bell while you're singing it, so. But it is a field, right? And it's nearby. That's what the story says, right? That the angels appeared to them, and they came to the manger to see Jesus. And then there's the milk grotto, which I actually have no idea what that is, but that's something else that we're stopping at. Maybe that's where they got milk for Jesus. I'm making that up. I don't know what it is. It's on our list. Until I saw this, I'd never heard of it. So obviously it's not in the Bible. All right. And so then we'll go to Jerusalem to spend the night. And then the next day is in the city of Jerusalem. All right. So next time we'll do Jerusalem. There's a lot to cover about Jerusalem and Mount of Olives, Masada, all that kind of stuff that we still have to get through the next couple of days on the trip.
Will they take, like, money-wise? Like, I know what we need to take for tips and everything, but, like, for lunch, do they take credit cards or do we need cash for everything?
Depends. Most don't. But the gift shops do. Most don't. What I usually do would get some shekels out of an ATM and then cash those into smaller coins, because the paper ones are pretty big denominations, and then just have that with you for lunch. It's not expensive to eat there, but you'll need shekels, not dollars, in a lot of those places. Because some places you stop for lunch, you just kind of roadside, you know, get in there and get a buffalo.
Will we have time in the airport when we arrive to be able to,
yes,
to get our money?
You can exchange there, or you can do it at the hotel. You can just use an ATM. And you'll get your ATM, I mean, let your credit card people know you're going, of course, but you can use your credit card at their ATMs and get shekels out right there if you don't want to do it at the airport. And it does exchange automatically at that point in time. So, one thing to keep in mind is on the Sabbath day, they can't exchange money for you because they cannot handle money. So make sure you've done that before the Sabbath, the day before for the Sabbath day. I think dunk, don't you? I think you're going to get all up in that. It depends on the nutria. If I'll let you choose however you want to go. I've only dropped 4 or 5 people dunking them, so I'm usually pretty good about it. That's right. Thank y'all.